It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. And in today's conversation, we're going to be talking to Franny Greenberg, who is a licensed wildlife rehabilitator and educator and a friend as well. And we're going to talk about wildlife education, rehabilitation, conservation, all those good things that a lot of you are very interested in, and what happens when we find an animal who's sick, that's a wild animal. And so welcome, Franny.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So why don't we start with the idea of where did you come up with the idea to do this, and what led you into the path to have a rehabilitation center?
I was the kid who brought all the animals home. As a child, if I found an animal, whether it be domestic or wild, I picked it up and home it came. And I was lucky enough to have parents who enabled me to keep things that otherwise might not have been ordinarily in my house. So that's really where it started. My dad started my first squirrel rehabilitation at a very young age when he brought two home. He had his own business. He was a plumber, had a truck, and two climbed into his truck. He put them out at the end of the day. Next day, they were back in his truck. Put them out at the end of the day, back in the truck. And then he said, okay, clearly you're looking for help. They came home, lived with us. And I guess that's really where the thought entered. But I did not do it here at our own property until 2015. And that's the time that our three girls were all off and on their own and needed less of me. And so it was a good time to pursue that passion.
Wow. So did you have to do some specialized training to be licensed to do this?
Every state is a little different. In the state of New Hampshire, you need 200 hours currently under someone who is licensed. At the time I got my license, that was not a requirement. There was sort of a background check, we can say. And I have a background in animal science and education. Right. Certainly that played a role. And then my background in the museum education field, where some of the museums I've worked at had live animal centers, and we did rehabilitation there. So there was definitely experience. And then over the years of being an education consultant, I very often would incorporate animals into that. So I had the background, I had the training. And of course, when you start, you don't always know what you're getting into. We really began thinking on a small level. And my goal was raccoons. No, I thought that was, I would start with six raccoons a year and we would save, knowing that I was still doing other work. I was still consulting. That was the goal. Well, this past year, we took in 974 animals.
Oh my goodness.
They were not all raccoons. So I have, knowing that there is a great need in the state for wildlife rehabilitation. And if I was going to say no, there was not somebody else who could necessarily take that animal. It was a matter of, you know, just saying yes and bringing in more. And the first animal I took was a muskrat. You know, I figured, well, raccoon babies aren't here yet. They don't need me. We'll take that muskrat. And then came the squirrels, and then came, you know, so here we are. That was 2015 when I got my license. And again, we've grown.
That's really actually a huge growth, and really positive for those animals. How far is your reach? So is it just New Hampshire, or do you reach outside of there?
The animals we take are just from the state of New Hampshire, and that is by law.
You cannot take
an animal across state borders, even though we are 12 miles from the Massachusetts border and they may walk or fly or crawl. By law, we leave them in their own state. It goes to disease control and just monitoring those species. So we serve all of New Hampshire. However, we are close enough to the border that one of our missions is really education, and it is talking to the public about how to deal with wildlife conflicts, what to do if you find an animal. We take many, many phone calls from Massachusetts, and we help and redirect them to rehabilitators in their own state.
So from the education viewpoint, you're kind of regional, but I mean, broader than just New Hampshire.
That's correct, yes. Right?
But your licensing, that makes sense, you know. Veterinarians are not allowed, you know, in a lot of states to be able to put something to sleep as well or euthanize.
Correct.
And so, you know, a lot of people don't understand that, that you know, think it's an animal and it is an animal, but that's the same truth.
Right. And that's a big part of many early conversations is I am 12 miles from you and you're closer to me than anybody else. Please take this animal.
That's amazing. Franny, when you think about, and it happens all the time, somebody finds an animal, you know, that it's in distress or, you know, it might be a squirrel that maybe it fell out of a tree or it had, we don't know, it's lying somewhere. What should we do?
That's a great question. We tell everyone to call the rehabilitator first. There are times when you need to intervene, and there are times when we would tell you to leave that animal. There are many orphan babies who are left by mom, and that's their strategy. Eastern cottontails are one of those, and that is a big need here in southern New Hampshire. We have an influx of that species. Their numbers 5 years ago were totally different. Now, probably most families have a rabbit in their yard and mom leaves those babies. She'll have a nest. She goes to that nest twice a day. It doesn't matter if they were born today or born 2 weeks ago. She'll go to them twice and only twice. She doesn't want you to find them or any other predator. So when you found them, you pick them up and you bring them in the house, I watched for an hour, mom didn't come. So we have strategies to tell people how to make sure those bunnies really are orphaned. Certainly there are orphan bunnies out there. If they're injured, that's another thing to know about. Cat brings it in, dog brings it in, lawnmower comes in contact with a bunny. Those animals, we don't question. You know, we're not waiting to see if mom comes back because mom's not going to have those antibiotics and the other means to help. But there are other species like that. So call first is what we tell you. Unless, of course, the animal is clearly in peril or it's, you know, a matter of we know that this animal has to come in. But even so, there are things that if you don't know, we try to explain to you. We want you to wear gloves. And it doesn't matter if this animal is 2 inches long and couldn't bite you, we need you to wear gloves. That not only protects you, that protects that animal. If an animal is considered a rabies vector species and you're touching it with your bare hands, even though you're trying to help that animal, we are then required to euthanize the animal to test to see if you've just been exposed to rabies. Because although we work with wildlife, we of course have to keep those humans in mind too. So we ask that you wear gloves, or if you have a barrier, sometimes people will call and say, you know, I've hit a raccoon, it's in the road, I have no gloves, but I have a car blanket. Car blanket can work. So we will walk people through the process. We try to use our Facebook as an educational tool and tell people, so if you follow us, you know in advance, okay, here are things I can have in my car, here are things I shouldn't do. And then at that point, we want our animals to be kept dark, warm, and quiet.
That's just really, really helpful information. And I, you know, I think people, I mean, the first part that you were talking about is, wait a minute, you know, or call somebody that has expertise before you touch an animal and, or move it from its spot. Because often that's true that it may not, that the parent may not want it back after it's gotten moved or have you sent. And so it's good to observe. Also, we're short-term thinking and we get think of them as pets, right?
Yes. And we try to remind people that our natural instinct is to pick that animal up, to pet it, to love it, to snuggle it. It's okay. I'm going to get you help. You'll be fine. We need people to remember that animal thinks of you as a predator. It thinks you're about to eat it for dinner. So your attempt to comfort and care for has really done nothing but increase the stress level. And we have many species of animals that with that increased stress often comes heart failure. We have people with best intentions bring an animal lovingly wrapped up, petting, you know, it was calm the whole way here. Unfortunately, it's passing because of the adrenaline. As far as would mom take that animal back? Sometimes people, you know, say, I can't move it, because we will advise at times, let's say you found a baby squirrel, it's fallen out of a tree. Most of those moms will come back. If mom is there, there are many species of animals that are diligent mothers. They are going to gnaw through a home. They are going to look for days. They want their babies. So we can guide in how to put that animal someplace so mom will find it. Predator won't be as likely to find it. It'll be warm when she does, because if a mom comes across her baby and the body temperature is so low, she will assume that the baby is not going to survive. And it is a big job if you're a squirrel to carry up a baby 20 or 30 feet to the nest. And if you don't think this baby has a chance, you'll leave it. So that comes into education as well. We'll talk to you about how to care for it in the meantime. And we'll let people know that primarily a mom is going to want this baby. So we can talk you through how to safely, for both yourself and this animal, put it someplace or keep it warm so we can reunite. That's always the first goal. If it's a healthy baby, we want mom to raise that baby.
So that's, you know, in the right now, it's kind of weird to be talking about summer and as cold as it is outward, especially where you are. But, you know, in the summer, sometimes I'll find a squirrel, and it's a full grown one, that will crawl up on my porch and just lie there. And they look like they're in pain or, but eventually they get up and go away. Are they cooling themselves?
They can cool themselves. If it is summer and it's warm, they drape themselves over branches or on porches, and they might look injured, but animals just like us, if you are really, really warm, assume the animals that are outside are probably hot and can overheat. Similarly, in the cold weather, they're much better able to be out there. Their fur coats and their undercoats keep them warm, but still they, you know, we have to keep in mind, if it's that cold out and we are offering them shelter here, you know, keep that in mind. Temperature does play a role.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because it's funny, you know, if you spend, which I do sometimes, spend some time watching, you know, eventually they come out of that almost that state of holding themselves to cool down, and then they move. I've also seen, and this is really interesting to me, you know, we think about bird strikes, which those are pretty big because we have so much glass everywhere, especially in downtown urban areas like where we are. There's lots of glass windows, and that happens. But I have actually seen birds hit the glass, look like that they're not going to be okay, and then almost miraculously, they slowly get motor function back and other things and then fly away. Is that a common thing too?
It is a very common thing, and we will advise people who have found a bird that's flown into their window or have found them anywhere, give them time. Sometimes it's as long as an hour and a half. and you don't have to leave them out in the hot sun. You can put them in a box in the shade near where they were, but don't bring them in the house because in an hour or so, you may have a bird flying around your home. So, you know, they've been hit in the head. They need to regroup. They need to, you know, just collect their wits, but that is very common. Another reason why not to quickly scoop up that bird. Good intention people think I've got to go now. It just happened. Sometimes waiting is the best thing to do.
So why call a rehabilitator over animal control?
That's a great question. A lot of that comes into education. Our animal control officers are sometimes able only to handle domestic animals. And okay. Of course, we are not doing domestics, which doesn't mean sometimes they don't get brought here. Sometimes people mistake a domestic for a wild. But animal control, typically their main function is to help in with domestic animals. Now, depending on their time and their own interest, they sometimes can help, but they are not always able to run to your home. You know, you have an animal back there and you don't want it. We don't deal with nuisance animals. And nuisance, we don't think they're nuisance, but we get calls. People don't want the woodchuck eating in their garden. They don't want their skunk in the backyard. We don't take those animals just because you don't want them. And again, education comes into play. We're going to try to help you live with those animals or talk about how, if it's not safe for that animal, ways to encourage them to move out without intervention from animal control or that homeowner or from anybody here.
Wow, that's really, that's a great answer to that. What is the strangest animal that you've taken in recent times?
Well, I often get calls. Thankfully, there are cell phones and most everybody has one. But I often get calls. People think they have one animal in particular and it's not at all that animal. So I once had someone call, they found a young porcupine. Can they bring it in? We do a lot of porcupines. Send a photo because you think people would understand, you know, they know what a porcupine looks like. It's probably a porcupine, but send it. Well, what they had found was a young furless mouse and it was near a porcupine quill. So they made that leap, this, you know, not really knowing, they must think, and it's understandable, porcupines at birth have no quills, have no fur. This must be a baby porcupine. So that was an unusual call. We had recently a short-tailed weasel brought in with the thought that it was a ferret. So, you know, there is that mistaking, even if it looks very much like the animal, you know, there is some blood relations. So there's a ferret is related to an ermine, which is a short-tailed weasel. But you know, it's always a surprise when that phone rings. I don't know what's going to come.
Yeah, and that has to make what you do to really, really. You mean that's got to be one of the enjoyable parts of your job? Is that, and I know you as having been an educator for a long time, and I know that's your passion as well to be able to help people through the process of education and understanding.
Absolutely. And it is, you know, I do have a passion for working with these animals, but a big part of it is teaching the people that have found the animals, what have you found? And follow up, we like them. Now you'll maybe know what to do when you find an animal or know if we're able to release it back on their property. There's some education that goes with that as well. What habitat do you have? Or if it's not okay to put this animal back on their property, why and why not?
So one of the things, you know, if they don't go to a rehabilitator or somebody with expertise, I know this from even domestic animals, you can be feeding it the wrong thing. And some things are very toxic that you wouldn't think for one animal, but they are for another.
Yes, and we do find that. We get calls from people maybe a week in, 2 weeks in, I found this baby and they want to raise it. They want to show their kids and their grandchildren, especially in this environment where there's so many people homeschooling. This will be a great science lesson. I will bring this animal in, we'll raise it, we'll release it. Perfectly good intentions, not necessarily thinking it'll become a pet or family member, but very often there are serious consequences because we're not feeding what you might expect an animal to eat. And we're very aware of their diet and also positioning. We get a lot of baby animals. People have tried. They said, well, we knew it at least needed water. But what people expect is like we hold our human babies and we put them on, you know, they're held on their back and we're feeding a bottle. If you hold a wild animal in that position, chances are whatever fluids you're using are going to go into the lungs. And now we have animals that have aspirated. We have to treat pneumonia on top of the fact that it's an orphan.
Well, that's, you know, that really is helpful. Because I, you know, this all goes to the thing that we tend to do with animals in general, even our domesticated animals, and that's humanize them. You know, take what we know about children and ourselves and then place that upon the animals, even on their behavior. So I know that people like with a dog, they will, you know, do something during the day when somebody's gone, like, you know, chew something up. They come home and then they punish the dog, but the dog has its time. It's gone right. For the dog. And all they think of you as being mean, they have no idea. And so we can just extend that right further to each wild animal. It has a different set of habits, a different way of wanting to be handled.
Yes.
And so that, I think that's interesting.
And many of them don't want to be handled. That's right. Regardless of the size. And there are ways to handle them that makes it safe for the animal and safe for the human, even if it's a porcupine.
That's great. We've been talking with Franny Greenberg about wildlife rehabilitation and rescue. Please join us for more conversations after a short break.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation with Franny Greenberg, a licensed wildlife rehabilitator and educator. And Franny, when we left for the break, we were talking about, you know, each species being a little different and being wanting to be handled differently. But when you go as a rehabilitator, so you've handled 700 animals this year, you've got all different kinds of species. How do you actually do rehabilitation on different animals?
In the state of New Hampshire, we are not funded by state or town or the government. Actually, that is true in most states, which means rehabilitators have opened up their home, and we have done that very thing. So over the course of the last few years, we've gone from a few animals to actually we're pushing 1,000 animals this year. So we have needed to dedicate areas of our home as being animal rooms. The benefit of having my children be grown and out of the house means that they never know what they're going to find when they come back to see their childhood house, but we've got rooms that are now dedicated as animal rooms. What we do when we get an animal is it is first the intake. We find out all the information we can from the finder. Where did you find that? And maybe this finder is not the person bringing the animal. It might be animal control. It could be a local police officer, which is animal control as well. Sometimes we get calls from local veterinarians. Animals have been dropped, so we're picking them up. But we find out all the information. What do we know about this animal? How long has it been either injured? When was it found on the road? When was it found away from its nest or wherever you found it? Has it been fed? Has it been warmed? And then we do an intake after that. There are times, and people think, why are you not instantly acting? There are times that that animal is so stressed from riding in a vehicle or being handled or petted that the best thing to do is nothing at all. Of course, we triage, and if it's a matter of stopping bleeding or giving pain meds first, we do that. But then often we have to let that animal just relax a little bit before we do the full exam. That full exam tells us whether or not that animal is viable. And unfortunately, we do have to deal with euthanasia, which is basically, if you think of the word, it means a kind death. Right. Sometimes as hard as it is, it's the kindest thing we can do for this animal. After that point, we usually hydrate an animal. Most of the time it needs fluids, whether that be by mouth or subcutaneously. We're making sure that they've got what they need, and we calculate that by weight. So we weigh the animals that come in as part of that initial exam. They don't always need food right away. And being the kind people that they are that have found them, everyone wants to feed an animal. You know, we'll find all kinds of things in a carrier if they've found an animal. And we remind people, as a human, if you're in an ambulance on the way to the hospital, you're not asking the driver to pull through the window of a fast food restaurant. That is not our main concern. It's not their main concern. And then over the next days and weeks, we are either putting them in an incubator, we are putting them in whatever sort of environment they can be quarantined in. If need be, we have to be aware of disease spreading. And then over time, we're raising them and giving them the skills to be released. That's always our goal, is to get them back out where they were, whether they're an orphan that needs to spend a month or 6 months here, or they're an adult that just needs surgery or a splinted leg and then can go back out. The goal is to make sure that they leave capable of being on their own.
So you're able to do the triage that you're talking about and those things. But when it gets more complicated, when you talk about surgery, do you have veterinarians that work with you or help you to do that?
We have veterinarians we work with. We go to them. So we have a primary veterinarian in Manchester, and he will do the surgery. If it's something, you know, more than putting a splint on or more than the initial triage, we bring them elsewhere because we, although have brought in a lot of animals, we are not a veterinary clinic. I don't have the ability to x-ray or ultrasound or any of those other things that are often needed.
So it begs the question, you know, you've got the animals, your goal is to get them back out. Do you have animals that don't, because of their injury, just can't get back out?
We do have non-releasable animals. So we use those when possible for programming, because we are concerned with education and teaching the public. And we get a lot of calls about, you know, can we tour your facility? And we don't bring people here. And people are, you know, you have so many animals, we want to see them. Reason being, these animals are getting ready to be released. We don't want them comfortable with humans. So we have our animals in spaces where they see limited numbers of people and they're really getting ready to go. But we go out, we can take our non-releasable animals and do a Girl Scout troop or go to any other facility when it's not our baby season, because at that point, it's all hands on deck, you're feeding babies, it's really tough. But we do have animals that cannot be released. Currently, we have a male fox that was habituated. Unfortunately, someone found this animal, brought him into the home, kept him with family, with dogs, and he does not have any idea that he is a fox. So he will be here forever. We're glad to have him, but it's unfortunate that he can't be wild. We have a female red fox. She has only three legs, and her third one of those three legs she doesn't typically use. So she really scoots around and could not find her own food. We have regulations when we do that. If you have animals that are not releasable, they have to be able to find their own food. We can't have an animal that has to be syringe fed for the rest of its life. So it has to have some quality of life, and they have to be registered both with the state. And at that point, you end up needing a federal license as well. And so USDA makes sure that we're doing everything we need to do to keep these animals. And it really is the best thing for them as opposed to a euthanasia.
Yeah. And, you know, it makes me think, you know, we have certain regulations in the Midwest, and you probably do, on box turtles because they're so threatened. People find them on the road or something, but not hit necessarily. They think they might be, and they bring them in and they think they'll be a nice pet, but you can't do that. And there's a lot of reasons for why. Why is it not good to bring any type of wild animal into your house?
Well, there's many, many reasons. There's the reason that the human may then expose themselves to disease. There are all kinds of external and internal parasites. This animal, which is friendly today as a baby, is going to reach maturity and then will be biting. There's the safety of the human, but there's also the consideration of the species. We need not to just take this animal and habituate them and make them unable to care for themselves if you're not committed, and it's not legal to anyway, but people think, well, this will be fun, not realizing that turtles are likely to outlive you. So we also need, when it comes to turtles, to know that they have a little internal GPS system, and where they're hatched, they know where they're headed. So even if you think, well, you know, this is not safe, I'm going to drive them down the road, they're going where programmed to go. Right. So yes, cross them, get them to the other side of the road, but you can't take a box turtle that you have found in Indiana, let it go in New Hampshire, and expect it to be fine. It's going to start heading for Indiana. And it's too long of a walk. So there's the consideration of the species as well as the human.
Yeah, that's really a great answer to that part. And when I think about, I, like you, always, you know, had animals around all the time. And then working in museums, we always had animals. But it was different when we used them as an educational process rather than, and we never handled them quite as pets. But I do get the idea of why you wouldn't want someone to come. So what you're trying to do at your center is you're trying to get the animal calm. You're trying to get it reacclimated to being not with humans, to get out and all that. And so if you have visitors coming, you're probably constantly putting them under stress. Whereas zoos and other places, those animals begin to acclimate to the fact that there are people.
Correct. And not to say that we don't have animals that we do handle. Those are the non-releasable animals. Right. Those are the animals that will do programs. But our main goal is to release.
Wow. You know, you were talking about who does the euthanasia. Is that again done through a veterinarian? Does it have to be there, or can you do that?
It depends on the species. Typically, we can do it here. Okay. We have some means. It depends on what the size of the animal, the day of the week, because an animal that I might want to take to the vet's office, you know, we get a lot of them after hours and on weekends.
Right.
So we utilize both veterinarians, animal control, but we do some here as well.
Okay. How many staff do you have now that you have to handle all this?
Well, we, as I mentioned, we do not receive funding. So I am the head person that does the phones and the intake and the animal care and the programs, but we have a lot of volunteers.
Okay.
And during the summer, we typically have a 12 hour period when there's volunteers coming in. Probably six volunteers come and help do the feeding and the cleaning and the laundry and everything like that. We also use some offsite volunteers. We have people who say, you know, I want to help. I believe in your mission, but I don't want to clean cages. I will, however, cook scrambled eggs. We have somebody today picking up 12 dozen raw eggs, and she will cook them and bring them back. So as far as staff goes, we have no paid employees, but we use whoever we can, whether that be an offsite veterinarian or volunteers who come here. My husband is retired now, so he has been volunteered. And
for Michael.
Yes, we use his expertise. He's, you know, jack of all trades, and luckily his animal science background comes in handy there as well.
That's really interesting. So is that true of a lot of rehabilitators, that they have to really do it all?
Yes. If you're going to have animals in the state of New Hampshire, and again, many states are like this, you have to be prepared to do a little bit of everything. Know that you're going to have to clean, you're going to have to euthanize, you're going to get the part where, you know, those treats, those wonderful moments are the ones where you're at that release and you get to see what you've done, or, you know, you're holding that animal that you thought wouldn't make it through the night, but after every 2 hours getting up with it and feeding it, just seeing that we've turned that corner, those moments come as well. But there is a lot of hard work that comes with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Franny, can you receive funding? Are you a nonprofit and you can receive?
Yes, we are. So we have gone through the steps of becoming a 501c3. We are a nonprofit and we can receive funding, whether it be by the finders or organizations, charities. Yes. So we do. That's one of those other things. And having a museum background comes in handy, because often museum employees have to do a little bit of everything as well. So my experience doing some grant writing comes in handy here, and we do our best to bring in funds so that the animals have what they need, whether that be incubators or medicine,
food,
or just the food. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Or their cage or whatever.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of things. And I was thinking, people need to kind of remember that when they're thinking of their gifts that they make each year, that those are important gifts to make also. Is just, I wouldn't have thought, you know, you don't think, because you guys can't market as strongly as, for instance, a large museum. And so people may not be aware that that is a place to donate, but that is really, would be so helpful and so welcome.
It would indeed be. And so we try to let people know. We have a donate button on our Facebook page, and we do our best to let people know that we're not funded. Most people think, you know, New Hampshire Fish and Game probably provides all you need,
right?
But that is not the case.
Not the case in that. Wow. So just a reminder that the Adventure Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersection between art and science. We're going to encourage you to explore what Franny and I have been talking about at home with your family and others, and have those conversations yourselves. And we'll be right back.
We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone, connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope, furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Welcome back. I'm having a conversation about wildlife education, rehabilitation, conservation, and welfare with animals with Franny Greenberg. Franny, what really comes to mind for me is the idea of, you keep expressing it and talking about how important education is. In education in general, but specifically about wildlife. How does your education background support what you do?
I think it certainly helps me know how to speak to people, whether it be on the phone or in a public setting. It helps, I guess, my approach in sharing information about wildlife. And my experience has been, for many, many years, teaching children and adults in different settings, but understanding that sometimes you know, the unexpected is necessary for, you know, a little bit of excitement and understanding how programs should be evolved and shared probably helps in our mission here to teach people about the wildlife in their backyards.
Mm. And you, when you go about it, there are several ways of thinking about it, but I know that the training that you had was more from an interpretation, and people may not understand what that means, than to just give them facts or to lay on the science heavy. So when you're let's say you're going to a Girl Scout group, or you're going out to a group of seniors and you're going to do a presentation, what are some of the first things you do to get them engaged with you?
It's important first for them to feel comfortable. Not everyone, we expect, oh, everyone's going to love to meet this opossum. So we start basically by making it a comfortable, fun environment to be in. Whenever possible, I am big on hands-on education. And although the animal itself is not one of those items that can be passed around or handled, we bring a lot of other artifacts with us that can be touched and just hopefully will help people spark their interest and spark questions. It's important to have it be fun. You know, facts are all well and good, and kids like to know facts and be able to go home and tell three things that they learned, but it's more important to have them learn those facts in a different sort of setting. So we like to have conversations like you and I are having here when possible, and let it be open, and stories are fun. When the group is kids, you have to make sure it's not all storytelling, and we try to save some of those for later, because first off, we get to that part of the program. We want them to see these animals and see how they move and understand their habitat. And it could easily, as you know, be 45 minutes of someone telling me about, you know, about the possum that lived on their back deck. Yeah. So we're careful about stories a little bit till the end. But yes, welcoming questions. There is never a bad question. Hopefully eliminating fears and just sharing something that is new and different to them.
Yeah. And, you know, I think about when you're first talking to them and doing that, probably knowing a little bit, you've saying storytelling, but from your side, having a little bit of story of the animal, which you sometimes do, is really helpful, I would think.
Absolutely. And whether that be the background of the story, this is why I have this animal. Someone mistakenly thought it was a different species or thought they could care for it, or just a story, whether it be how a chipmunk got its stripes, an old, you know, a Native American proverb, fun things like that as well. So stories are important.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. And they do help. Having a wife who's a veterinarian, I know that the stories help when an animal's in stress, and because the human gets stressed too. And I'm sure even with the animals that you have, they get stressed about things. So being able to relate, well, I had this happen too, or I had this experience.
And very often the phone calls come from someone who is stressed. So that is part of it as well. You know, yeah. If it is by phone, it's calming their nerves. Or if it is in person, letting them know porcupines don't shoot their quills. That's an unfortunate misconception.
Yeah,
some cartoon years ago has ruined everyone thinking that this porcupine that's near them is going to now take aim and fire.
Yeah. And what I think is really interesting in the education side is how delicate it is to take that balance of moving somebody who has what we call a misconception. Really, it's a conception that they have, but it's misinformed, maybe because of a cartoon. And you have to gently move them from that to somewhere else. You can't say, oh, that's wrong. You know, you have to kind of take them where they are. And that it's in and of itself is a really tremendous skill that you have. So
thank you.
When I think about The second, I mean, the third part of this, which was when we talk about conservation, how does what you do contribute to conservation?
We are helping specific species, certainly, whether it be, we do many, many eastern cottontails. And so certainly putting them back out in the environment helps that particular species. We realize that when I put animals back out there, we're not tracking them. I don't know how long they're going to make it. I know that they are bottom of the food chain, and we spend many, many hours putting some of these animals back that will be dinner, whether it be that evening or a week later, but we're helping other species make sure that there is a food source for them. Animals that we put out there are vaccinated if it's appropriate. So we're helping to make sure we're keeping disease down. We're making sure that if there is a pocket of disease that we're seeing a particular town with a lot of distemper, that we can report that, we can manage disease control in the state as well.
Are you able then at the center to isolate if you know that an animal has something that's infectious?
We do. We do isolate. Sometimes we isolate even if we don't know there's a disease, because often when an animal comes in, they're not presenting with that illness yet. So we do quarantine the animals that come. And then a lot of our animals are social. So when we know there's no, you know, we've treated for whatever it is, or we've vaccinated, many of them are much happier living with others of their own species. And that's something we aim to do, but we always consider the animals that come in to be diseased, just to be on the safe side. And if they're not, that's fabulous.
Yeah, and that makes complete sense, because you really, these are not domesticated animals. So we really don't have a way of having the owner give us a history, you know,
exactly.
or the mom or the dad. And so, yeah, you kind of have to, that makes perfect sense that you from the get-go have to have that idea that maybe they are worst case scenario first, and then keeping them safe. The social animals, that was interesting. What animals are particularly social?
We have flying squirrels who come in this time of year is when we typically see them. We get babies sometimes in the summer, but they're now moving into people's homes, trying to stay warm. That's when they're found scampering around. They live in colonies of 20 to 50 sometimes, and they do not do well alone. So we don't release unless we know them to be put into an existing colony, unless we have six of a species to put out there. So they're happiest when that first flying squirrel comes. We know, you know, there will be more, but they are much happier in a group. Same thing with raccoons. Sometimes you think they're out there on their own, but we don't release single raccoons. As an adult, a male may be out there on its own, but they travel in band of brothers. So when possible, when we can put them together, we do.
Yeah, when you're camping, they steal your bacon as a group too.
They do. Yes. Yeah. Smart enough to make a plan.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that's really interesting. So when you start to socialize them, do you need a larger space to have that happen? And how do you do that?
We do. And here you might think, you know, how many cages do you need, woman? You have, you know, you don't have 10,000 animals, but an animal comes and it may be in a small container. As it grows, it ends up in a small cage to a very large pre-release cage. Whenever we put two animals together, we basically put them in a new habitat. So that first animal or that group of animals, like this is, otherwise they think this is mine. Even a social animal, you worry about that new one being the outcast. But if it's maybe as simple as new linens and we've wiped everything down and it's not my blanket or your blanket, we're putting these little guys together. But we start fresh and they're all in a new environment, and then it's easier for them to figure out how to cohabitate.
That's a really good point to make too, because even the domesticated animals that we all have, when we're, it's a delicate process of introducing a new animal. So you get a new dog or puppy and you're introducing it, and especially with cats, you're introducing them in. There's going to be a part of the time settling down because one's going into the other's, you know, territory and space.
Exactly.
And we forget that they also have territorial which is part of their survival.
Yes.
So, yeah, that makes, I really like your idea of that you, it's not just a bigger cage or not just a different environment, but you also take care to make sure that some of the things that were from the other environment are just aren't in there. So they don't become those vectors for us getting in an argument.
Yes.
Wow. I mean, you make me just, it's unbelievable how many things you have to think about. As a rehabilitator and doing that. Do you do anything with birds or does it take another person type of rehabilitator to deal with birds of prey, for instance, or large birds?
We have chosen to do just mammals. There are a couple of people in the state that do birds of prey. So we send them there. If they're dropped here, we can get them there, but there's only a couple of people in the state doing birds of prey. It is another license. It's also another amount of space.
Yeah.
You of course have to have flight cages and right. have to make sure before they're released, they are, you know, sometimes very, very large spaces, whether they be circular or otherwise.
Yeah.
So we refer our birds elsewhere.
Yeah, I would think that would be that one you talk about how difficult that might be. I mean, not only the space, but I just didn't being able to feed them. Their diet is so different. And then do you get lizards or anything?
We have never been called on a lizard. We have snakes and turtles, but no one has yet found a lizard. You've got to remember, sometimes there are species, well, there are certain species people are not as comfortable with picking up, but often, you know, if it's a car versus lizard, the lizards here in the area are small, probably
it's
beyond.
Been euthanized, health. Unfortunately, in a, yes. not a positive way.
Yes.
That makes sense. So where do you get the snakes from? People are okay about calling you about a snake?
Yes. Our most recent one came from a dad and son, and dad was doing a great job using it as a teaching moment. The son was interested in following the snake in the yard. He went in a wood pile and he moved a piece of wood trying to get to the snake. It rolled on the snake. And so he was injured, and dad, you know, taught him like, look, now we're going to get it help. We're going to figure out what we need to do. And we know you were not trying to injure this snake. You were learning about him. We'll learn about this snake in other ways. They followed the recovery. We were able to release that snake, followed it as we did things here. And when possible, we're happy to answer texts. I know people would like a daily update and daily photos. We can't always do that. No. Don't have the staff for that, but when possible, we try to keep people updated. Your animal has been released, and unfortunately, it's not always a good outcome. But they need to know that as well. They have to know that every time an animal comes, it's sometimes that's just what happens. As we do have animals that pass.
Yeah, you were earlier mentioning that you have peak times. I would assume that spring, when there's lots of little babies being born, is a real peak time for you.
Absolutely. March, those calls start coming. Usually we get gray squirrel calls first, and that continues and picks up through the summer. October, it starts to slow. By that time, some of our animals that, like a raccoon, is normally with mom, sometimes a whole year. We keep them at least 6 months till we know they're able to take care of themselves. So by October, we're able to get a lot of our orphans out the door. And here in this part of the US, we're not seeing babies born. I mean, there may be a late baby here and there, you know, some animal moved into a home and they were found in the attic, but primarily by that point, it's the injured animals that we're doing through the winter.
Yeah. And in the winter, because I would assume conditions are harder in terms of weather, but also camouflage goes away.
Yes.
Especially in deciduous areas, they're more vulnerable to having a predator get them.
Yes.
Might be in the summer. So yeah, you're going to see probably a whole different, like you said, a whole different type of a situation where it's more injured than it is something where it's abandoned or they think it's abandoned. Yeah, that's
yes.
amazing. You know, it makes me think, you know, the way I've built this show is about connecting to art. And I noticed behind you, you know, picture of raccoons. But do you do any photography with what you do with these to document or to turn them into inspirational kinds of things for people to think about?
So we haven't done it as a documentary necessarily. We hear for our own purposes, and some of the college students getting credit have tried to do some photography. This is what this animal looked like on intake and release. We have some of our volunteers who do beautiful work, and when they're in, we can let them in with an animal. If it's somebody that has their rabies vaccination, that's something humans can be protected up to. We make sure our volunteers are safe with these animals. We have not done a lot other than for our own purposes, for our own walls, our social media pages. We did do but speaking of art, our art connection for you is we make sure enrichment is available for all of our animals. And that might mean a wheel for an opossum or a swimming pool of goldfish for raccoons. but enrichment is important. And one thing we did this summer was we let our raccoons walk through a safe, non-toxic finger paint. And then from there, raccoons love, you know, they just have to feel everything. They use their hands. So they thought that was wonderful. And then we let them walk on canvases. So they had the enrichment. We were left with beautiful canvases that we used as a fundraiser.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, that's really neat. Somebody woke up back there and is talking to us.
Oh, yes. You're hearing, even though they're nocturnal, I have our non-releasable possum is here. That's Petunia in the background, snorting a little and checking to see if there's food anywhere.
That's hilarious. That's so great. Franny, this has been a wonderful conversation. Franny runs the Millstone Wildlife Center in Windham, New Hampshire. And until next time, this is Mark Kiesling reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.